This is Phil Farrand. Okay. The key slipped out of my hand and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I picked up the key and it slipped out of my hand, and then I was fumbling around trying to find the key, and then even after I found the key, I couldn't get it into the keyhole. Anyways, it's been a good week. Got a lot of stuff going on this week, and big week this week. Tomorrow, they're going to, hopefully, I'm not immediately involved in this project, but I do have project oversight, and tomorrow, theoretically, we're going to be cutting away from 4 decades old code. So, this will be exciting. The code that we're cutting away from was written in the 70s, and it's been running ever since. And so one of the programmers who was connected longer than anyone else to the department that I'm working with, that programmer has been working for years now to build a replacement for that code, testing. We've been running parallel, you know, and so tomorrow's the day. Tomorrow is the day. So it'll be interesting to see how that all goes. And I'm actually not going to be there, but of course I'll have my phone. But, I mean, the programmer who has worked on it has worked for that department, helping that department for 3 decades, I think. Over 3 decades, somewhere around there. So, you know, I mean, he is well-respected and well-versed and well-able to get done what needs to be done. So, and I've been telling him on and off through the week, praying for you, all will go well. And he says, and he told me today, he said, you know, Christ has been kind to help us in the past get things fixed. I said, yes, he has, and he will be in the future. So we just rest in that assurance and we'll move forward. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, I'm kind of on the outside of this one, so it's easier for me to be jovial about this, but, you know, it's whenever you're cutting into a new system, especially a system as big, as complex as this is, there's always the potential for something to go sideways. But we've done it once already with this same system with another department, so, you know, we'll see. I think it'll be fine. It'll be fine. All is well with the writing. I got to 95,000 words last week. I could have gotten a little farther, but, I had a situation where, I had lost some time early in the week, and I was in a section that needed some real focus and concentration, and so that slowed me down a little bit. And I think at the end of the day, I got within 1,800 words of being at 10,000 words last week, but over the 9 weeks, I was at 95,000 words, which is over where I'm supposed to be, because it's 10,000 words a week, and you know, you get to the place where you're coming right on the end there and you're switching gears and it's like, well, you've got to be what your goal was. You know, it's okay. Just relax. Take a breather for a little bit and then we're back into the next book. So Sunday, I ran sound both days and so I got a few other little things done. So then Monday, I started editing book 10. So now the information has come back from the beta readers, for most of them. And who usually get me back information. Not all of them actually return stuff to me, but that's okay too. And they're working on getting, I have a couple who are working on getting finished up, and then I started entering the information from the books. The first step is I take all the printed books that come back to me and I enter that information into a PDF of the interior of the book. And then everybody who sent me PDFs back, I just go ahead and export those data files and re-import them into that same PDF, and then we're off to the races. So hopefully I'll get all of that entry done this weekend or early next weekend or early this week. And then I'll start my read through early next week. And that'll take week and a half or so. And then we'll build some files, and get files uploaded, order copies for the free book list, get that done. And then come July, we'll get back to book 11, get that finished up. So book 11 is in pretty good shape. I've still got a lot of things to work out as to where we go, but I think we're okay. I think we're okay. I told somebody by the time I get to about halfway through the book, I basically have all the balls up in the air, and then I have to figure out how to get them all caught on the way down in a satisfying way, without dropping any of them, because sometimes that's what happens. You drop them and then people are not happy because you dropped it. So that's all well. I think that's about it. Haven't been any big dress-up days. On Friday I did a rerun, but no one recognized it was a rerun, so it had been long enough. I wore the t-shirt that I wore on Friday with the socks, I think, last July, and pretty much nobody remembered it, which is just fine. I had a request that was logged for the Permade socks, which are socks that I have that have kittens on them, and their lower half is a mermaid, so those are Permade socks, so I think I'm going to do that this Friday, since I had a request log, and that's done with my Elephant in the Room t-shirt. That's a cool t-shirt. That's a really cool t-shirt. You look at it and it looks like the blueprints for a house, and then you look closer and the blueprints, if you look the right way, actually are in the shape of an elephant. And of course it's the Elephant in the Room, and it's really well done. So it's very clever. I love t-shirts that are clever. Anyway, so this week, it's been a good week. Had meetings with friends and breakfast with friends and chat, video chats with friends, and it's all been good. Lots of things going on in the world, here, there, and the other. People are raging and shouting and suggesting this and suggesting that, but, you know, step at a time, we just keep moving forward. And, there's a lot of interesting things that are going to get resolved over the next 2 years or so. It'll be interesting to see how all of those work out. For today, and I will say right at the offset that I am not as prepared as I should be for this particular article, because there was so much stuff in this article. It was a really good article. And he tried, there's a little bit of cutesy, tried to be clever in the title of the article, which is fine, because the title of the article is Dude, Where's My Frontal Cortex? So, and the man who wrote the article, Robert Sapolsky, is known, a friend of mine actually said, hey, you should really check out this guy's YouTube stuff. He said, I think you'd enjoy it. Robert Sapolsky is a professor of biology, neurology, and neurosurgery at Stanford University. He has a book out called Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst, which that sounds like an interesting book. And I'm always interested to hear what the scientists are concluding, what the tests are that they're running, understanding that someone like a Robert Sapolsky is going to explain everything from strictly an evolutionary standpoint. And that's fine. Because as I've said in the past, when people say evolution, I just swap that out for designed for adaptation. So in this particular article, as might be guessed from the title, he's talking about the development of the adolescent brain and then attempting to give some reasons for why the adolescent brain might be this way. And I found it very article. There's a lot of stuff that he talks about in here, and I'm not going to touch all of it. I'm only going to touch some of it, and I probably won't do that good of a job on all of it because I was a little rushed last night. I actually talked to a buddy last night, and, you know, so that kind of threw my schedule a little bit. I was still trying to do some editing. I ended up not doing any editing, so I had to get to bed, blah, 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 blah. But anyways, so he starts off the article talking about the foothills of the Sierra Mountains. A few hours east of San Francisco, he said, there are the Monin Caverns. It's a cave system that begins after a narrow, twisting descent of 30-some feet and then an abrupt 180-foot drop. Said the Park Service has found ancient human skeletons at the bottom of that drop. However, Native Americans living there at that time didn't make human sacrifices, as far as we know. Said instead, these explorers took one step too far into the gloom. And he notes that the skeletons belong to adolescents, so... So the picture here is that, you know, you probably have a tribe and mom and dad are like, be careful, don't go down in there, be careful. And of course the adolescents wander down in there thinking, I'll be fine, it's great, you know, and then thunk. Much of this happens at the Grand Canyon as well. So he talks about the fact that the teenage brain is different. I mean, we think about the teenage brain being almost adult, but he said that's, you know, he says it's not quite true. And he says the thing that's odd about the teenage brain, and he goes on to evolution, he says the frontal cortex is the most recently evolved part of the human brain. It is where the sensible, mature stuff happens. The long-term planning, executive function, impulse control, and emotional regulation. It's what makes you do the right thing when it's the harder thing to do. But its neurons are not fully wired up until your mid-20s. So, you know, it really is true that adolescents and young, what we would consider adults, they're not quite full-brained because it's just that way. He said, it's a central tenet of genetics that the genome that we start off life with back when we were just a fertilized egg is passed on to every subsequent cell in the body. But if the frontal cortex is the last part of the brain to mature, it's the brain region least shaped by the genome and most sculpted by experience. That's very interesting. Says, our success as primates, whatever, our success as primates and as individuals revolves around social intelligence and adapting to the subtleties and idiosyncrasies of the environment. This is the portfolio of the frontal cortex. So it's going to develop the ability to do this right. If it's going to develop the ability to do this right, it's going to have to be profoundly shaped and informed by every smidgen of experience along the way. Said, like evolution itself, though, maturation seldom follows a straight and narrow path. Adolescence reminds us that life has rivers to cross, some fraught with turbulence. So he says, At the onset of adolescence, the frontal cortex is the only brain region that has not yet reached adult levels of gray matter made up of neuronal cell bodies, which is very interesting. Said it would seem logical that gray matter levels would increase thereafter, but no. Over the course of adolescence, frontal cortical gray matter volume decreases. Says this occurs because one of the cleverest things brains ever evolved. Okay, sure. During fetal development, mammalian brains generate far more neurons than are found in adult brains. Why? Because the fetal brain holds a dramatic competition. Winning neurons get to migrate to the correct location and form the optimal number of connections with other neurons. Neurons that miss the cut undergo programmed cell death. Neuronal overproduction followed by competitive tuning, and he said some call this process neural Darwinism, allows more complex and optimized neural circuitry, the wonderful example of less being more. This is pretty interesting. So you start out with this mass, this generic mass, and as you experience inputs, as you interpret them, as you put them together with sensations and all that kind of stuff, your brain is actually knitting that all together, figuring out what neurons fire efficiently, all that kind of stuff, pruning away the ones that don't so that you eventually end up with this brain that is optimized. Okay? He says the same thing plays out in the adolescent frontal cortex. At the beginning of adolescence, gray matter volume is greater than it is in adults and subsequently declines as less optimally connected neurons are paired away. Within the frontal cortex, it is the evolutionary oldest subregions that mature first. One moment. The spanking new dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, for example, does not even begin to lose its gray matter volume until the end of adolescence. This delayed frontal cortical maturation means that adolescents aren't at adult levels of expertise at various cognitive tasks like recognizing irony or what they call theory of mind, the ability to operate with the knowledge that someone else has different information than you do. In an adult, the frontal cortex steadies the activity of parts of the limbic system, i.e. all your hormonal stuff, a brain region involved in emotion. In contrast, in the teenage brain, the limbic system is already going at full speed. In other words, hormones. While the frontal cortex is still trying to make sense of the assembly instructions, the result of this imbalance is that emotions are more intense. If you stick people in a brain scanner and show them pictures of faces expressing strong emotions, in the adult, there is the activation of the prime limbic structure. In other words, they see that, oh, that's an angry face, the amygdala. Shortly after, there's an activation in the frontal cortical regions, which damps down the amygdala response. Okay, calm down. It's just a picture of an angry face. It's not the real thing. But in the teenager, the frontal cortex response is muted and the amygdala's response is augmented. Okay, this means that emotional highs are higher and the lows are lower. This is shown in studies of limbic pathways that release dopamine, a neurotransmitter central to the anticipation of pleasure and reward. Average dopamine levels in adolescents and adults do not differ. What difference are the patterns of dopamine activation of this dopamine circuitry? Medium reward, medium activation, big reward, big activation. Now do the same thing with a teenager. Medium reward, big activation, medium activation, same as an adult. With a big reward, though, dopamine signaling increases far more than in an adult. a small reward of dopamine signaling decreases, a small reward feels like punishment. That's interesting. So you see, a medium reward is the same as it is in adults. A big reward is bigger than its in results. But a small reward, and the dopamine goes down. I'm getting the mail. So things are off. So he goes on to talk about the fact the delayed maturation of the frontal cortex also helps explain the defining feature of adolescence, namely the weird predilection for bungee jumping. Doing risky things is what he's talking about. Because when adolescents do risky things, they get a bigger reward from the dopamine system. So all of that's like really interesting. There's a lot more in this article. But, you know, let's just skip ahead. One of the interesting things is that when you try to do risk assessment, when you try to estimate how you are at risk assessment, the fact is that humans typically are bad at risk assessment. When you say, oh, so what are the chances of X will happen to you? Oh, it's about this. The difference between adults and adolescents is that when you tell adults the correct figures, they will course correct about good news. So if you say something and you say, you ask the test subjects to estimate the likelihood of some event happening to them and then tell them the actual odds, the feedback can constitute good news as subjects learn that a good event is more likely to occur than they thought. Conversely, the feedback can constitute bad news as subjects learn that an event can happen more often than they expected. Both adults and teens are likely to adjust their assessments when asked again about the likelihood of good news. In other words, if I think the chance is, whatever, you know, 1 in 10,000 that I'll win the lottery, this is not a good example. And then I find out that it's like 1 in 8,000, adolescents, like adults, will say, oh, well, it's only 1 in 8,000. However, teens alone don't get the picture about bad news. So it might go something like this. Researcher, what do you think the odds are that you having a car accident if you're driving drunk? Adolescent, one chance in a gajillion. Researcher, actually, the risk for people in general is 50%. In other words, if you're driving drunk, you have a 1 in 2 chance that you're going to get into a car accident. So the researcher tells the adolescent that, and then the researcher says, now what do you think your chances are? And the adolescent goes, hey, we're talking about me. It's 1 in a gazillion. So there's no change. No change. So this helps explain why adolescents have 2 to 4 times the rate of pathological gambling of adults. Okay, I'm going to skip forward. Of course, the problem is as the limbic system matures here, and at the same time, you've got other systems that are maturing, like the reproductive systems. He said the slowpoke frontal cortex is, of course, not the only explanation for teen behavior. Another factor comes into play that keeps the teen brain off balance, namely gonadal hormones like estrogen and progesterone in female and testosterone in male. This helps explain why adolescence is more turbulent than childhood. The frontal cortex is immature in both ages, but the tsunami of hormones haven't started in pre-adolescence. Hormones have numerous effects on function, both in the limbic system and frontal cortex. Testosterone decreases the ability of the frontal cortex to communicate with and rein in the amygdala. Not surprisingly, landmarks of adolescent maturation in the brain and behavior are less related to chronological age than time since puberty. The onset of puberty is not merely about the sudden onslaughts of gonadal hormones. This defining feature of ovarian endocrine function is, of course, the oscillation of hormone release. In adolescent females, puberty does not arrive in full flower, so to speak, but with one's first period. Instead, the first few years, only about half of the cycle actually involve ovulation and the accompanying hormonal surges. So not only are there major fluctuations in gonadal hormone levels due to ovulation, but also higher order fluctuations as to whether ovulation occurs. And fluctuations in hormones affect emotion and cognition. And he opens a parenthesis and he says, while an adolescent male does not have the functional hormonal fluctuations of his female counterparts, it can't be a great thing that his frontal cortex probably keeps getting hypoxic with all the blood flow to his, So, in other words, which, you know, that's probably, I don't know how much that is true, but certainly when those hormones are kicking off and a male's body is ramping up to impregnate, there's not much holding back in the frontal cortex. So then he talks about, okay, so what would be, what would be the advantage of this? There's more stuff here, but, you know, I'm home. So you can read the article, dude, where's my frontal cortex? And what he concludes is there's an advantage in this that our frontal cortexes are less involved and determined by our genetics than they are by our experience. So there may be portions of our brain, how we respond in anger, how we, you know, what skills that we just naturally acquire, those kind of, that are wired up genetically. But the portion of our brain that would be responsible for discipline, that would be responsible for regulation, that would be responsible for making good decisions, the portion of that brain does not get wired up until later. And theoretically, what would be great is that if each person who moved through childhood and adolescence had godly parents, or at least moral parents, who would model before their children how to succeed in life, truly succeed, not just make money, but truly succeed by manifesting the spirit instead of the flesh, teenagers could pick up on that and it would be great. But the difficulty is that when teenagers move into their teenage years, of course, they are in a storm of hormones, and that section of their brain that's helping them to make good decisions isn't formed up yet. And it was kind of my idea and my approach all along with my daughter that what needed to happen, and this wasn't necessarily original with me, I just kind of glommed onto it and I thought, wow, yeah, okay, we're doing that, is that first of all, from an early age, I felt like she needed to see that my belief system was beneficial for me. So she needed to see that there was success that came right out of my belief system. She also needed to understand on a daily basis that I loved her, not just for the resource she constituted for the family, but that I loved her. And I did that by spending time with her, by talking to her, by having her communicate with me, keeping that relationship open. The other thing that I thought was really, really important when I was raising my daughter is that I would be absolutely consistent, well, as much as possible, consistent both in discipline and also in my walk with Christ. So that if I would say this is the path that we should walk in, I would walk in that path. Because what I was trying to do was to build up a storehouse. build up a storehouse of trust, build up a storehouse of consistency, honesty, love, care, compassion. Because when we crested into those adolescent years, there was pretty much no question there was going to be some ruffling. I mean, you have too many hormones bouncing around and not enough frontal cortex to handle them. So there's going to be something. And all I think you can really hope for is that you built enough of a relationship that that relationship holds you through. You know, I've seen parents who are very autocratic with their children, and that never changes. So there's a time that I do believe in being autocratic between where you say and it needs to be done. Early on, I think there's a time for that. As the child moves in and starts maturing, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 in there, the child needs to be able to make more decisions. And the child needs to have, I think, the support of the parents and an understanding of when they do make a decision, it's not a good decision. The child needs to have the opportunity to hear the advice from the parent and then see how it works out in real life. Because once that child crests into puberty, the hormones and the flesh are going to try to push that child in a direction. And whatever frontal cortex is firing at that point, at the very least, that child needs to have patterns of trust built in. And if you're autocratic with your child and you do a because I said so, because I said so, because I said so, and you're dismissive of your child all the way through their elementary years, that kind of early childhood, mid-childhood-ish area. And if your relationship is simply of a relationship of I will tell you what to do and you're just supposed to do it, that'll work until you hit adolescence. But if you hit adolescence and you haven't built that relationship, then it's going to be bumpy. Now, eventually it'll smooth out, and hopefully the child will not do anything too devastating or harmful to themselves. You know, with Lizzie, we really only had one incident, and I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before. She had gotten together with the debate team, and it was really the first time she had kind of been in a group that was the cool group, and you know, a lot of them were very much in that kind of snide, critical age where nobody was quite as smart as them, nobody knew as quite as much as them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there came one debate meet when Lizzie knew she was supposed to be home after it, and it got to be 11 o'clock, and there was no Lizzie, and I started calling, trying to figure out where she was. She eventually ended up home at 3:15 in the morning because she said yes to going over to someone's house and watching movies when she knew that was not in the plan, and she didn't even ask for permission. So I met her at the door, and then we had a little talk. But there was no shouting. You know, there was talking and there was concern. And before it was all said and done, we were holding each other and we were both crying. And then afterwards I said, you know, sweetie, there has to be a consequence to this. And I just said, you're going to have to be grounded for the next, I think, month. We grounded her for a month. And she said, what? She said, I've got a speech and debate meet coming up. I said, I understand that. I said, have your speech and debate teacher talk to me if she has a problem. Speech and debate teacher either called her or she called me. She said, you know, we've got to. I said, I understand that. I said, but Lizzie made a decision and she needs to know that there's consequences to that decision. It was the only time we ever grounded her, as near as I can recall. It was the only time we needed to. And there was not screaming and throwing things and I hate yous and all that kind of stuff. None of that stuff was there. It was just, this is what we need to do at this point, because you know to understand this is not acceptable. And the rest of the time, I mean, it was, you know, it was just a delight. Lizzie was just a delight. I mean, she had a few little bumps here and there when she was, you know, she would keep pushing. She would always kind of push. And then would you have to have a little disciplining when she was a child, and then she'd push and a little disciplining. But then eventually she outgrew that. And her teenage years, at least in her relationship with me, were really pretty stable, pretty easy. And eventually she even, you know, kind of stabilized in her relationship with Ned, which there's all kinds of other reasons for that, which I won't go into here. But suffice that all to say that I do firmly believe that even though there is certainly a challenge raising adolescents, I do believe that if you lay the groundwork early on, build that relationship, if you are honest and trustworthy, and you show and demonstrate the value of a dynamic relationship with Jesus Christ, that we can actually guide our children through their adolescence, even though half their brain isn't formed yet. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it